Like, start a short one? Well, I could start one with couple of fellows. They were, it's kind of a transition one from the Vespers tonight. And these two fellows were arguing about who had the best rabbi. And the first one said that his rabbi was very well educated, and whenever he gave a talk, he although he knew his Talmud very well, he never used any notes. And the other one said, well, his rabbi wasn't so smart, and he didn't know the Talmud by heart, but he talked to God. The other one says, how do you know? Well, he told me so. Well, maybe he's lying. He says, would God talk to a liar? So you can improve on that. But I can, I'll start out with a more longer one. We're supposed to kind of give, if you have some unusual experience within your own life, sometimes they can be funny. We have, there's various towns in every place that, like in Oregon, I guess you could say Wolf Point. It's a really small, kind of a wide place in the road off the main highway. I suppose you have them in North Dakota, Minnesota, some crazy town like this, that whenever you mention it, people kind of titter. In the state of Washington, there is a town like this called Starbuck. It really exists, and whenever you mention Starbuck, you know, everybody's trying to say he's from the state of Washington. You kind of laugh, see. Well, that's how I remembered Starbuck when I left here from, I left General Electric Company and Battelle in 1965, went to California. And I'd sort of remembered Starbuck. It's one of these places that if you went through and weren't really looking, you might have passed it before you really knew it was there or knew you had gone through it. But I knew they'd built a dam there and a lot of things, so I was in 8 years in California, and I came back to Pullman, Washington. And shortly after coming, and I told this story to Q Club, so if some of you were at the Q Club a while back, you know about this. But I came back, and shortly after I got to town, just 3.5 years ago, it was in the fall of 73, I had this call from Starbuck, from the Starbuck Quarterback Club. They wanted to talk. They said every fall for the beginning of their club meetings, they bring in some notorious person. That means somebody from out of town. And they had seen in the paper where this guy was coming back to the state of Washington. He was going to be involved in veterinary school. And so I got this note, and I got to get out and talk to the troops and get some legislative support here and there, and maybe Starbuck was as good a place to start as any. So I hopped in the car and went out there for meeting. It was in September, the first meeting of their quarterback club. And I came into town. Of course, I hadn't really paid much attention. I got into town, and it's pretty good. Hold it for me. No, I'm telling about Starbuck. Well, I drove into Starbuck, and there really wasn't much there. They had a quarterback club, but no team. And there was a gas station, and then there was a grocery store, and the meeting was up the second floor, the grocery store. I went up there. I'm expecting there'd be a few people there, and got in, and it's a table there. It had seven or eight plates on it. There were six people there, And they had some pizzas that had been thawing in the hot sun all afternoon, I suppose, and they were cooking them up. Had Twinkies for dessert. So the guy responsible for bringing me there, I found out he was trying to get his son into veterinary school. That's why I guess he figured he was going to get me there. Didn't know I didn't have any influence at all on that, but I'm telling that for your benefit, too. He introduced me around, and I noticed that about five of the names were Scandinavian. And they finally sat down, and we had the pizzas and the Twinkies. And before I started, there another guy, the service station man, came in, and a friend of his dropped in for gas, first guy that day. So I brought him, too. So we had eight there. So I did my $8 talk. I mean, my eight-person talk. Well, I didn't think it was all that bad, but finished up, there was a little applause. Not really that much. And then I started to go. And the guy that brought me there, he says, "Well, you know, here's an envelope. I'd like to have you open it before you go." So I opened it, and there's some loose change and a couple of dollar bills, and I counted real fast. $3.12. And I told him, "Well, you know, I came down. I didn't come to be paid for this trip. I felt it was one of my duties to come out in my position to talk to people." I says, "We want you to have it. You know, it's people that aren't even here, Gabe." Well, that impressed me. But I says, "You know, I can't really in all good conscience take this." Well, he says, let me see. We'll call a meeting of the quarterback club. So they went down to the end of the room there, out of earshot. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the meeting of a quarterback club, but they go into a huddle. And I thought, you know, this is a great idea. I sit in on council meetings and stuff, and boy, they go on for hours and hours. If you were in a huddle, and you know, we have some hard arguments and stuff, and if you're in a huddle, you can't really kick each other easily, you know, you got your arm around them. And you can't stand that position too long. And you wouldn't want to if they've been eating garlic or forgot to use scope, you know. So I got some ideas from that. But their meeting wasn't very long. And finally, by this time, I'm thinking, you know, well, why? It's $3.12. I'm trying to get things going there at Washington State. $3.12 is better than nothing. I was about a mind to take it, see? So he came to me. He says, "Well, we had the meeting, and they voted that we'd probably keep the money, try to get a better speaker next year." Well, that was kind of a blow. And when you have a setback like this, you kind of have to analyze it. What went wrong, see? And I did. And I think my mistake was that I told an ethnic story. And you see, I told a story, since these were Scandinavian names, at least the majority were. And I told some of you, I told this story before, but it's a good story. This friend of mine, who's a Norwegian, was walking near the Swedish border out in the forest, and he chanced to meet a Swede who had a pig on a leash. And he was quite impressed with this, and he stopped the Swede with the pig, and he said, "Hey, that's pretty nice. Where did you get it?" "I won it in a bingo game," said the pig. And you see? And you see, where I went wrong was, All those Scandinavians were Swedish names, not Norwegian. And I was also wearing this button. It says Norwegian Power. That's where I made my mistake. So you always have to analyze these things when you get involved like this. So that's my story. Now it's somebody else's turn. Got a story about your relatives or anything?
Yeah, I can tell this about my relatives, and it's ethnic, and I can say it because I come by it honestly. My name, incidentally, for those of you who might not have met me yet, is John Shaughnessy, and I'm a Lutheran pastor, and I'm probably one of only two Irish names like that in the Lutheran clergy. However, I'm not Irish at all. I'm Swedish, half, because my grandmother is the one of seven children who was born of Swedish immigrants who arrived here in Pennsylvania, no, not here in Pennsylvania, but arrived in this country and moved to Pennsylvania in the middle of the 19th century. And there were seven kids in the family, and their name was Stenstrom, and that's my middle name. But the piece of land that great-great-grandfather inherited or got was divided up at his death so that each of the seven children could have a piece, a segment of the property in which they all had equal footage in the highway. So if you see this on a blueprint, it looks ridiculous because you get these long, skinny pieces of land that aren't good for much except to put a trailer court there. You know, the trailers lined up end to end to end to end all the way back, long, skinny pieces of land. But it so happened that my Aunt Hannah inherited the property that had the house, the farmhouse on it. My Uncle Gene inherited the property that had the barn. And the other five sisters inherited the other five pieces of property. The house sat on the second lot in from the end of the property. And since it was her house, I mean, since she inherited the house with the property with the house, she kind of felt compelled to see to it that the house was properly kept up, and as the modern day moved in on them, that they had some of the more modern conveniences. So she had the place wired for electricity. This was way back in the 20s. She had the place wired for electricity. Had the contractors come out, and they just put all the electrical switches in and all the outlets and all the fixtures for the lights and, you know, for all the modern 1920s electrical wiring that you'd want to have. And she was all set to have the power turned on and have the hookup made with the power company, and she found out that in order for the electric company to do that, they would have to install a power line or a telephone pole, on her sister's property, the first lot in. And there was no way in God's creation she was going to ask her sister for permission to put that pole on her property. So to this day, that house sits there, wired completely for electricity, and not a single watt of electricity has gone through it ever. Because she was not about to ask her sister for permission to put the power line pole on her property. And that's a true story. I'm not sure about the Swedes and the pig, but that's a true story.
I need to tell a story before my wife gets here.
All right.
That way you won't forget it.
I'll tell her. Except I probably forget. There's three things that happen to you when you get old, you know. First thing, you lose your memory. And I can't remember the other two. This is Roger.
I decided to go to the seminary, become a Navy chaplain. I never wanted to enter the ministry. And my flight crew, which there were 24, 23 plus me, decided to give me a going away party. And they challenged me to, they would pay me $1 per drink, a piece. Later that evening, after everyone had tried to go back to bed, I went to my room where the navigator was with me. And I was just climbing into bed when I heard this feeble voice saying,
Roger, I don't feel very good. So I boldly got out of bed, helped him into the bathroom, and as he was getting rid of it, not feeling very good, I was holding his head. And about that time, as I was really helping him, he grabbed hold of the toilet seat, it pulled down and hit me right above the eye. And I had a great big black and blue mark. We'd been married about 3 months, Annette and I. And I got back off the plane the next day with this big mouse. And she said, Roger, you know, very tender, what happened to you? Before I could say anything, one fellow says, oh, I got hit by a toilet seat.
Yeah, he does that. A friend of mine was trying to show his little boy just how you use that toilet. And he decided he could best do this by actual demonstration, so he got on his knees. And the little boy let the toilet seat down. They had a family reunion kind of thing, and a little 5-year-old girl came up and whispered in her mother's ear, and her mother said, well, you know what it is, just go. So she went, and she came back, and oh, she was just wringing wet. And she went around to each of the 4 men that were in the room and said, either you, or you, or you, or you, left the toilet seat up.
Could we now graduate to another room in the house?
Yes.
No, that's a good one. So that's a good place.
This happened today. I told a couple people about it, but when we were here 5 years ago on the staff, I was librarian part of the time, and there was a man, I hope he's not here tonight, from Seattle, I think, and was kind of discussing one day, and he said he wanted to go out, the paper was 2 days old in the library. He wanted today's paper. I tried to explain that life is more relaxing at Holden, and they come up day or two late sometime, and the news is sort of the same anyway. And then I, after lunch, I went back to the library, and all the papers had been taken off the racks and pushed into the waste basket. So I thought, this must be the man, the same man must have done this. And so I saw him later, and I said, did you find the paper you wanted? He said, oh no, they were all too old. I threw them away, you know. And so, anyway, then I put a little note there and said, save the papers for Alice Spica, you know, for the future weeks. And today the librarian came up to me, I had the name tag on, he said, oh, you're Alice Spica. I've been looking for you. There's a note in the library to save the
Who else?
I've got one.
Good.
This is one, I'm borrowing it from Al Rogers, who was here in May. And he told us one of the funniest things I've ever heard. I still laugh about that about 6 weeks ago. But it's a story concerning a Norwegian pastor back in the early part of the century when many of the immigrant churches were beginning to switch from their native languages to English. And the pastor had a particular difficulty with this, according to Al. He needed things to come out right. And this particular pastor was presiding at the funeral of a Civil War veteran. And there was a full drum and bugle corps and all this other stuff in the church and everything else. And the pastor at the beginning was giving sort of the plan for the whole funeral. And so he said, first the corpse will play, and then we'll pass around the beer, and those in union seats will go first.
to the bathroom.
We got a telephone call one night, and it was the wrong number, and I answered it, and this boy said, is Mark there? And I said, no, there's nobody here named Mark. And the boy hung up. So the phone rang again. Same thing happened, and so I hung up again. Rang again, and so my son answered the phone. And he whispered to me, it's the same kid. And I said, tell him he's not here. By this time it was getting kind of funny. I said, tell him he's not here. And so Jim said, he's not here. And the party on the line said, where is he? And I said, tell him he's in the bathroom. And Jim said, whispered to me,
the kid says, I'll wait. I have a bathroom story, too. That's a true story. After a couple in Toledo being ready to go out one evening, wife is in the bathroom first. She's just about finished. She's doing her hair, spraying it. The can wouldn't stop. So she got excited about this. Didn't know what to do with the spraying cans, but she dropped it in the toilet. Put the lid down. It finally died out, her husband came in. That's right, you got it. He sat down and he was a smoker. Calling the rescue squad, came to the house promptly and investigated the call and found this man up in the bathroom in his face, and they put him on a stretcher and they wanted to know what had happened. While he was explaining this, as they were carrying him out, they dropped him down the stairs and they broke his leg.
Dr. Busted sermon tonight, he was talking about drugs. He was in about 5.5 minutes of his 18.5 minutes. And he mentioned drugs and pot. And some of you know by now that I was a juvenile delinquent. Well, I had this one kid that I'm working with now who apparently has quite a serious alcohol problem. I didn't think he was too bad, though, until his mom told me that the last time she made a birthday cake for him, he blew on the cake and lit the candles.
That's almost a Wes Spreeb joke. Is Wes here yet?
Nancy mentioned the Al Rodman story. I thought probably she'd come up with the other one that Al was telling about the Tom Reprobate who died. And he happened to be a Quaker. And so there was a funeral from the Quaker meeting house. But this fellow had been nothing but nuisance and trouble around the town all his life. And they sat around in the Quaker meeting house waiting for the spirit to move somebody, and it being kind people, the Quakers really wanted to try to find something that could be said about this gentleman before they put him in the ground. But nobody was moved to say anything at all, so they finally had to adjourn the meeting and go out to the graveyard, which is alongside of the meeting house. And there again, they were very reluctant to make the next move because it was really too bad to put this mortal down into the ground without saying something nice about him. And finally, the man who was obviously the kindest man in the community stepped forward and said, there is one thing I think we could say about old Tom. he wasn't always as bad as he usually was.
I have a secondhand story along with the other two. Spent some time in South America, and got to know a friend, a fellow that had spent a number of years there. He'd worked in the Peace Corps, so he'd been around a number of years. And South America being a Catholic country, seems like every other week there's some kind of festival in which the statues are carried on these heavy, heavy biers. And one of the processions in which the Virgin Mother was being carried around and about the city, they actually lost control of the whole contraption, and it fell, injuring and killing four people. And the headline in the paper the next day said, "Virgin kills four."
Yes?
When I've been working for 3 or 4 years, after I was married, I was in a group that had a picnic every year. It was about 30, 40 miles, I recall. And one of the events of the picnic was to tell a story, and whoever got the most applause or something like that got a trophy to keep on their desk for a year. And I told a story, and which went back a little earlier in the marriage, and won this trophy to keep. So I can honestly say this is an award-winning story. when we've been married, I think less than a year, or about a year, we were living in an apartment which was the upstairs of the house. And one night after dinner, I noticed my wife was standing in front of the mirror primping, combing her hair and fixing her makeup and all those things that women go through. And I was kind of surprised, because I didn't think we were, I knew no plan to go anywhere that night. I wondered what she was primping up for. And she finally looked at her dress as though maybe she'd want to change that, but she kind of smoothed it out and said, "Well, I guess I look good enough to take out the garbage."
I'll try one. I feel funny about telling one, because it seems that every time I laugh, except my own jokes, nobody else ever does. But I'm going to tell three really short ones from my emergency room work experience, which I started about 4 years ago. And the first one was I was working 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. on New Year's Eve. And I had these really personal concerns, and I thought it would be really neat to get on the citywide intercom and wish everyone a Happy New Year. And so I said to the orderly, "Is it going to get on the intercom and say Happy New Year, to all the rescue squads in Omaha?" And he dared me, and he said, sure, go ahead. And I guess I must have been pretty agreeable to dare. So I got on the intercom without introducing myself or anything, and said, "Happy New Year to all the rescue squads in Omaha from Emmanuel Lutheran Hospital." And I thought that was really neat, and I hung up. And right away, the police phone came ringing, and I answered it, and this person said, "Let me check the person that was just on that squad box." And I said, "Oh, that was me." I was laughing. You're just liable for a $500 fine. You just, whatever, you just went over FCC regulations. And I wasn't laughing anymore, and then I hung up, and it's the first time I ever remember. I thought it was hilarious. But I thought I was going to lose my job with that. But I didn't. Anyway, that was the first one. But the how I speak, I reversed my words a lot, and I had to get on the intercom a lot. And one time I had to inform someone indirectly, or no, I was directly, but they were indirectly involved with the person who died of heart failure, only I turned the words around. Heart failure. Difficulty breathing, only I said breathing.
Any other hospital stories?
I'll tell you a chaplain story. I served as on active duty with the Navy chaplaincy for 4.5 years. And it was the my first burial at sea. And we had this all set up. There was a Navy chief that had retired, and he had died. And the wife, following his wishes, said, "Fine, we'll have the burial at sea." And I was a destroyer chaplain at that time. And so our squadron got the assignment to handle this detail. The body was brought aboard. In fact, the ships had been out on maneuvers, and so one ship came in. They picked me up and picked the body up. And prior to this time, the day before, I had heard of another burial at sea, in which when the body went off the ship, at the right moment, it hit the water, but with such force that the body came out. And so I heard about this, and I said, "Hey, now, don't want that to happen." And so I called the funeral director, and he said, "Well, we've done everything that BuMed says to do, and we've got the holes in it, and the man was a heavy man, so therefore it should sink." Fine. And so we went out, and we went through the maneuvers that were required, and then off of Santa Catalina Island, we stopped. And we had the ceremony. I had, again, all the formalities that were necessary. We had brought the son on board ship and another chaplain who was a friend of the son. And so we were all there watching what was about to happen. We had greased the board so it would slide nicely. And at the right moment, gave the signal, and it slid down and went over, and there it floated, and floated. And a seagull came along, flapping, and it landed on the end of the casket. And the other chaplain there, talking to the boy, said, "Well, isn't that nice? There's the Holy Spirit coming down." We're trying to figure out how can we sink that casket, you know? And so the first thing we did was make sure that we mentioned the other chaplain, let's get him down to the wardroom. So they took him down the wardroom. And they lowered the whale boat. And they went out, the motorized whale boat, they went out and they pushed on it a little bit. And that didn't work. So they came back in, they got some empty casings, they got some chains, and they went back out and they put it around that, and part of it sunk. They had to come back in for some more casings and change, and the whale boat conked out. And so here they're rowing in to get more, to complete the job, and the Commodore is standing there up on the bridge. He's looking down at me, and he's signaling like this, you know, to come in. They said that was the most sacrilegious thing that he had ever seen. And I know, heard one of the officers said, well, why don't we train the gun on it? But my first experience and only experience with a burial at sea.
Did it finally sink?
Yeah, we sunk down. I'm waiting to read in a paper that a casket came up on Santa Catalina Island. No, not at all.
I have one kind of question. I'm not that serious, but years ago, my husband and I had a little old, clunky fishing boat. It was an inboard fishing boat. And we liked to go out on Puget Sound, those of you from Western Washington and Juanita, about fishing. And this one day, the kids were in school, we went out fishing, and there was a man out there who had overturned in a fishing boat in Little Rowboat. And so we rescued him, and it was very difficult to do that. But we got him on board and brought him back, and he left, and everything's fine. So that afternoon when my kids came home from school, they said, well, what did you catch? And I said, we caught a man. And my youngest son looked around and he said, I don't see anybody.
What did you throw him back?
I think one that's a pretty good one. It might be a little difficult to tell. This is about the height of the Inca culture. One day they were conquered. The conquerors came in, they were conquered. And they just weren't used to being under other rules, so whenever they had to do things for the conquerors, and that they would come. And this infuriated the conquerors after a while, so they started, every time the Incas would hum, they would tax them. And this is the first recorded Inca hum yet.
I'd like to follow a good one like that. This happened out on Midway Island in 1957. It's a rather involved story. It's actually three stories, but it's one. And that's when we used to walk out to the flight line carrying all of our parachutes and walk through the coral dust. And then every once in a while there'd be a military jeep from the Air Force would drive by and they'd never slow down. There's just a cloud of dust and we would sort of go like this and keep on walking. And so the whole Air Force group took off and left one time and they locked everything up tight, which Air Force always does on Navy base except one jeep. And we kept looking at that jeep. And then one day, looking out at the atoll, you can see way out on the reef, an old encrusted coral jeep, where, you know, really messed up from World War II. So with many chains and a lot of manpower, we pulled that jeep off of the coral reef. Of course, it sunk into many fathoms, and we pulled that chain, all of us, pulled the jeep up. Now, it took many days to do this. I didn't take place at anything past that. But someone else had taken the engine out of the old Jeep and the engine out of the new Jeep. And they put the coral one in the new Jeep and closed the lid. That was the end of that story. We always wondered what happened when the man pushed the button. It didn't work. He raised the lid and looked in. But that Jeep engine had a life. It ended up being taken into pieces and smuggled back into the Hawaiian Islands. And eventually was put together and put in Henry J. that was my plane commander's car. This is a stolen Air Force Jeep engine in a Navy commander's car. He never knew about it. He thought that his engine had been overhauled. The whole thing was sold as he was leaving the islands to an Air Force officer who happened to be the security officer for Hickam Air Force Base. Before he got a hold of it, and papers were in his hand, the car was still driven by the commander, and as he was driving down the road to his going away party, he was carrying his own going away cake in the back seat. And the head-on collision happened in the tunnel of the Polly, and the cake came over the top and landed all over him. And of course, the car was a total wreck. And someone happened to inform the Air Force officer that that engine, which he had the papers to, was a hot Air Force Jeep engine. And so it was stolen. And so the headlines, you know, talked about this. Eventually it was taken off the end of
the Hawaiian island chain there by Oahu and sunk with many chains and casings and things over it. Now, that's still not the end of the story. Having known all this, and my plane commander was living in Lawrence, Kansas, I came through, or flying through the area, I stopped in Wichita once and called him long distance. And this is a man who's never been at a loss for words. And so using a fictitious name, I said, this is Lieutenant of the United States Air Force Security, and I wonder if you can give me information about a Air Force Jeep engine which disappeared on January the 21st, 1957 from Midway Island. It was really quiet on the other end of the line. And then he came on. And as we talked a little more, he finally recognized the voice. He came on with that fantastic nickname that I have. But that's the story of an engine.
That was your nickname.
No way. Yeah.
Might be it hadn't been there, but I'll find it. Oh, cut. These are coffee. About 4 years ago, I drove and owned a 1962. The front end was a 1962 Nova, and the back end was welded on with a 64 Nova. And it did not have a thorough floorboard, and the gears. Three-speed on the floor that was all messed up. And my sister owned and had for quite a while a 1955 Ford, which I bought from her to drive out here last year. But she had this car, it was classic. It was a four-door, nothing wrong with the body, a real tank. It was just great. And we were going somewhere to get the same place, but both in separate cars. In the summer in Nebraska, we were inside the city of Omaha, and I was ahead of her, and I came to a red light and I stopped, and she came up behind me and decided to rear end me rather abruptly and did, and I looked and started laughing real loud, and some guy was sitting next to me, so she backed up and did it again. I just started giggling my head off, and this guy is looking at me, you know, so she did it three times, she rear-ended me one more time, and I just couldn't control myself, and I looked at him and I said, it's all right, she's my sister. He just looked at me and drove off. I was really
about his dad. He said that they were sitting around getting ready to eat at the family dinner table, and they had the phone right nearby, and they were just ready to say grace, and the phone rang, and he picked up the receiver and says, come Lord Jesus. My favorite joke is one of my husband's actually. He told at a reunion, high school reunion from a farm community. So that in that context, it was even more apropos possibly. But the one about four little bulls that were eating and grazing in the pasture, and the one little bull was saying to the other one day, he says, I'm going to town and be a bull in the china shop. And another one wasn't going to be beaten. He thought for a minute. He said, I'm going to be a bull on the stock market. And the third one just, well, he had to think for a while, but then he said, I'm going to roam and be a papal bull. Okay, and then the fourth little bull sat over there grazing, or stood over there grazing away, and didn't have much to say, and the other started looking at him and said, what about you? He says, I'm just going to stay here for heifer and heifer and heifer.
That's
case he goes back to Starbucks. Yeah.
Well, that's my second trip to Starbucks.
Oh, that's good.
My Swedish great-grandfather that I mentioned earlier, who was an immigrant from Sweden in the middle of the 19th century, he was a farmer when he got to Pennsylvania, but he wasn't a very good farmer. He decided, first of all, that what he wanted to do was to have a chicken farm. So he went out and bought himself 3,000 eggs and then went and plowed his field and planted each of those 3,000 eggs. And when the harvest time came, there were no chickens. So he thought he did something wrong. So the next time planting time came, he went out and he bought 3,000 baby chicks. And he went out and plowed his field and planted each one of those baby chicks in the field. Harvest time came along and no chickens, no harvest at all. So I thought he was doing something wrong, and he wasn't, you know, he was a first generation immigrant, so he didn't know who to write to in this country, so he sent a letter back to what would be the Swedish Department of Agriculture and explained to him exactly what he did. And a few weeks later he got a letter back, said, "Dear Mr. Stenstrom, please send us a soil sample."
I was at a Norwegian luncheon club one Saturday noon, and at the end of it, the man who was the toastmaster was a pastor. I guess maybe that's why he had the joke. But he was a minister of one of the large churches in Minneapolis, and all of a sudden he stood up, the meeting's about over, and he said, "Oh, we just got tragic news." He said, "We just heard that there's been a tremendous fire in the library in Stockholm. The whole thing went, and both volumes burned."
But they hadn't, it wasn't so tragic because they hadn't finished coloring one of them.
When I married a full-blooded Welshman, and there's nothing more stubborn than a Swede and a Welshman, I don't believe it. And so once in a while we get into it about our ancestry, and he turned and I said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with a Swede. They may be stubborn, but there's nothing wrong with a Swede. They're pretty good people." And he says, "Well," he says, "I got one on you." He says, "A Welshman is the only person that can buy from a Jew and sell to a Scotsman at a profit."
Maybe I could just share an evening that we had, in case any of you young marrieds are thinking of having a large family. We have six children, and we seemed to feel like we could just never get to bed before midnight, and so we were really going to try this night. We just had to try to get to bed early. And it started out fine. We got the kids, the younger ones, in bed by 9:30, and a lady stopped in for coffee, and so we had coffee for a while. Well, that was pretty safe because her husband was done on the 10:30 shift, and he'd be gone, so she had to go and get him. So 10:30 came, and she was off, and we started up the steps to bed, and I heard this buzz in the doorbell, the doorbell chime thing, and soft buzz. It wasn't too annoying, we could live with it, but I felt of it, and it was hot. Man, you can't go to bed with that, it could start fire. And so my husband immediately started to figure out how to take this. You think this was fairly easy. We couldn't get the thing off the doorbell chime to stop the buzz. And it was getting, you know, pretty hot, and we felt, man, you know, you just can't let that go. And we tried and tried and tried, couldn't get it off. So we finally had to call this guy back who had just gotten off the ship. We knew he was still up and could maybe help us. So they came over and worked at it a while and got it fixed. And then took him till it was rusted on or something, I guess. Took him till about 11:45. And he finally got it off and disconnected wires so we could go to bed safely and wake. And so we're just starting up the steps again, and my oldest daughter called, "Mother, She had sprung a leak in her waterbed with 2 tons of water. She had grabbed it at the leak so that it wasn't leaking, but that meant, you know, she couldn't sit there holding it. So we got a hose, and for the next 2.5 hours, we were siphoning the water out the door downstairs. And this was, let's see, that took till about 2:30. And about that time, we tried to get into bed again. I'd just gotten into bed, and my son comes home from his late restaurant night work, and he says, "Mom, I need a baby bottle. I need a doll bottle right away." And I says, "Oh, Kurt, it's 2:30 in the morning. What do you need a doll bottle for?" Emily had her baby rabbits. There are 11 of them, and she's starting to eat them. We got to feed them. And so 2 blocks down the way, his boyfriend and he were feeding their baby rabbits, and I'd send him off with one eyedropper, and I tried to look for, I could, oh, you can't, 11 bunnies, it'd take him till morning. So I quick looked for a little plastic rubber glove or something, or straws we could use, and got dressed and jumped on the bike, and then down 2 blocks and helped feed bunnies until 4 o'clock in the morning. But you do come up with some interesting
yeah.
I saw Wes come in. Did you see Wes come in?
Hey, Wes, you got a story for us?
Are these supposed to be true, or are they not?
Well, there hasn't been a true one told yet, but I guess you could be the first one.
Well, put it this way. One time I was over in Pullman, Washington, I believe, yes. My car broke down there. I didn't know what to do, and the garage owner said it would take 3 hours to fix the car. So I spied a Baptist church across the street with a funeral going on. So I decided to go in there and kill time before my car could be fixed. So I sat in the back row, and the preacher announced, "Anybody who wishes may get up and give a eulogy for the deceased." So immediately I stood up. And I said, "Well, since we got a lot of time to kill here, I never knew the deceased and I was never acquainted with him. But however, since we got a lot of time to kill here, I'd like to talk to you all about South Dakota." So after the funeral, the hearse driver the undertaker gave the hearse driver the signal to go to the cemetery. However, the hearse driver made a mistake and went through a plate glass window in a drugstore. And the casket slid out in front of the counter, and the clerk came up, and the man in the casket sat up, and the clerk said, "May I help you, sir?" The man in the casket said, "Yeah, have you got anything to stop this coughing?"
Like a pet store, sort of a pet store. In Seattle recently, they had a robbery in a pet store, which there was a whole bunch of pet birds stolen. And these people, you know, they wrote them a note the next day saying that the pet birds were okay and that, you know, for, say, $10,000 ransom, you know, give them back it. No, because they were a really valuable bird. They had, you know, all these African ones and the like. Then the police, you know, they came out with what they were going to charge him with if caught. They're going to charge him with extortion, burglary, theft, and contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
Hey, Wes, as a footnote about your story, it's not the cough that carries you off, it's the coffin that carries you off.
Actually, though, I've heard you tell a true story. The pastor was preaching, old Norwegian pastor was preaching at a funeral. And he absentmindedly said, "The shower is here, but the nut is gone."
We got it. We're going to close at 10 o'clock. We got room for one more if someone has one.
How do Germans tie their shoes? Into the Nazis.
That's short and sweet. Thank you all very much.